Hi, everybody. My name's Sandy Beach, and I'm an alcoholic. How you doing? I guess that won't stay there. My sobriety date is December 7th, 1964, and I have nowhere near the sobriety of Peg Martin. But I try to live up to her every day that I've been sober. I was thinking when Steve was standing up here that in AA we have a saying, principles before personalities, which has a very powerful meaning. But there have been personalities in AA that have been absolutely essential. And I was thinking that 20 years ago, somebody had a vision about something like this, and he acted on it, and he slowly put together this dream that started small and just kept expanding, and I just think, where would we be if he didn't follow through on that dream? And so those of you that are new, you have a dream in your area. Maybe we ought to have a conference. Maybe we ought to have a AA boating outing or whatever. If it popped into your head, act on it. It was probably put there for a reason, so that that would be your service, your contribution. There are these things all around the country. I'm so happy. I grew up in New Haven, Connecticut, and in a few months, there's going to be the first conference in New Haven. I can hardly wait to go there. And somebody arrived and said, let's do this. And a lot of people said, I don't think we do it that fast, but it's going to happen. And I just want to thank Steve for staying with his dream and staying with his vision. Because I'm sure there was a lot of times when things changed and things got canceled and it looked like Bank of America was going to own AA. And he hung in there, so I'm one grateful guy tonight. As I said, I grew up in New Haven, Connecticut a long, long time ago. And when I was born, there was no AA. And the alcoholics just did the best they could. They went into sanitariums. They mostly got locked up or died. There just wasn't anything that could transform their lives, which no one knew that that was necessary, but that was not in existence. And so when I was 4 years old, Bill Wilson got sober and had that miraculous experience. And when I was 5 years old, AA got started. And when I was 8 years old, the Big Book came out. Now, I'm totally unaware of this parallel existence that is going on. But it's kind of fun to look back on it. And when I was about 10 years old, I had my own personal awakening in the Catholic Church, where my mother had sent my sister and I. My sister has 30 years in AA coming up, and is one of the organizers of the New Haven Convention. And we sat together in the Catholic Church. She thought it was the nicest place in the world. The nuns were cute, the Latin was cute, the incense was cute, the whole deal was cute. I thought it was similar to Auschwitz. It's how I saw the whole place. I was terrified. I was frightened. I took everything literally. And as I stared at the crucifix at around age 10, it spoke to me and said, little boy, do you see this? And I said, yes. This is what God did to his only son that he loved, what he's going to do to you. And that was my, deep down inside, that was my emotional relationship with God. It was not fun, and it was nothing that I really cherished, that I got none of the benefits, I completely misread the whole situation, which most of us do, as we're putting together our story. You see, that was my story. My story was there was a very frightening God that got me when I was a little boy. Why didn't he get my sister? Well, he liked her better than me. You know what I mean? You just have to cover all the bases. I had no idea. I thought all of this was true. If I thought it up, it's true. And we all did that. Whatever you thought up, that's what you had to live with. That was my reality, having nothing to do with reality. It was my reality. So let's see, when I was... '19, AA had its first convention in Cleveland. And I was at the local university in New Haven, Yale University, where 2 years earlier, a botanist named Dr. Jelinek had done the first studies on alcoholism. And they hired a botanist, the people who wanted to get a handle on alcoholism, because they're so good at observing minutiae and details and looking, you know, at plants and how they move and all of the little tiny details. And so he ended up drawing that famous Jelinek curve out of all of that that many treatment centers carried for years and years and years. But it was a very surface level understanding of alcoholism. But when I went to Wits End a couple years ago and went into Wits End where Bill had all of his personal papers and stuff, there was one large bust in the window. It was the most dominating thing in the room in terms of statues. And it was Jelinek. You know what I mean? It was so important then that anybody had taken a look at alcoholism. Because up until then, it was just the denial of the entire country, much like we have today, that yes, Uncle So-and-so's a problem, but we'll step over him and go on as if there was no problem. I didn't see much drinking when I was young. It was my sister was aware of it. I just don't observe well. My mother comes from an Irish family, and it turns out everyone was an alcoholic. All of my uncles, she had 8 sisters and brothers, and all of them were alcoholics and died of alcoholism. My cousins died of alcoholism. So it was all around me, but I was unaware of it. So I took my first drink at age 19. I'm a freshman in college. I have grown up in the 30s. World War II came along. All of my uncles went into the war. I mean, it was the main event. I mean, my mother was an air spotter up on a hill looking for planes, and the submarines were right off the East Coast. I mean, we had blackout curtains so that the light wouldn't show at night. And every month or so, my mother would look into the pantry and see if there was one more pot made out of metal that she could take to the center of town and throw in to be melted down for bullets. I mean, it was just, you know, took the focus for 4 years or more. And when that all ended, there was the great exhilaration, and the country was just a wonderful place to live. It was so optimistic and so exciting. And I'm in this environment where my mind can be challenged, where there are people from all over the country with wonderful points of view, and it was the opportunity of a lifetime. But I didn't deserve it. I sat amidst those other 1,000 freshmen, knowing I shouldn't be there and wondering when the dean of freshmen on the old campus and announced they had an imposter in their midst. That guy, and get me out of there. That's how uncomfortable I was in my skin. And the pressure of just not belonging was acute. It affected my studies. It affected my ability to really function. And my roommates kept suggesting I have a drink, and I declined. I'm going to wait. I don't remember why. And finally, it just became too hard. And at some sort of a social event where we were supposed to introduce each other, I looked around and saw that I was unable to approach any of the guys in that room because I could see in their eyes that they didn't want to know me. And I couldn't stand the conflict of walking through that pressure of someone not wanting to know me. And so I decided to leave, but on the way out I did have a drink. Then I had a second one, and I'm waiting to see if it makes you feel good. And it didn't. So I was thinking of leaving, and I turned around, and everyone in the room wanted to know me. I could see it in their eyes. The people had been transformed by my drinking. They became different because of my drinking. I don't remember feeling that different. I just remember the world transforming itself so that I belonged. This was the world that everybody talked about. This is the world I read about. This is the world the church was talking about. This is the one I had never seen before. I remember having a fleeting thought that I should have started drinking in grammar school. Because what an amazing thing to have happen. It was close to an Alice in Wonderland, spiritual awakening, whatever you want to call it. It was not a minor event. This was amazing to me. I could not believe it. And if three drinks did that, what do you think 20 would do? And I went through with, you know, the first time you drink, if you do that, you get quite ill. I woke up the next morning, felt like I was going to die, like there was a hatchet in my head. I vomited. It was just, you've all done it. And I sat on the edge of the bed, and the thought occurred to me, are you going to drink again tonight? And I swear to you, to this day, it was less than a millionth of a second when I said, yes. And part of me said, well, what about you're almost dying? And I went, well, that's a small price to pay for what I had last night. What I had last night is worth dying for. You follow what I'm saying? That experience was such a peak experience that I was willing to pay quite a price for that. Little did I know, or little did any of us know, what the price was going to be. But whatever it was, count me in. So if there had been the alcohol god who warned all new alcoholics before we proceed to drinking, and he had arrived and said, son, before you have enter your second day of drinking, I just want to make sure we understand the terms of this agreement we are about to enter into. Are you willing to give up your high grades for this? Yes. Count me in. Yes, that'd be fine. Okay? You will not be on any athletic teams like your heart is set on. Is that okay? Yeah, that'll be fine. That's good. That'll be fine. You're going to start getting in fights, going to jail, getting lots of... That's all right. I could do research in jail. I could learn. I might want to write a book about jail. Get Harvey's experience, write little books. Or your family won't speak to you. They could have kept on going, and I would have said, yes, yes, yes. And they could have said, would you give up your soul for this, for that experience that you had? Yes. I never use it anyway. I'm not even sure what it is. My point is, I can't think of anything that could have been said to me to dissuade me from going back the second night. I cannot imagine anyone coming up and being able to say anything that would have stopped me. That's how big a deal it was. For non-alcoholics, they don't have that kind of a story. That is not the transforming experience that you're willing to die for. That's kind of beyond social drinking. Now, I didn't know I was different. I didn't know anything. I just said, hey, now I'm partying with the guys. Now I am one of them. And of course, all those things happen. The grades, the fights, I was thrown out of the college 1 year, had to live at home and then go back. I wasn't thrown out of the university, I just couldn't live there. And somehow graduated, barely. The Korean War was going on, the draft, everybody had to join something. And a group of us were drinking beer and said, let's join the Marine Corps. And I went, yeah, Marines, yeah, great, great, great. And went racing down and said, I do. And a few months later, I went off and started my relationship with the Marine Corps, which is a very rude awakening to start with. But it is one of the greatest organizations I've ever been in. And I ended up loving it so much that I signed up for a career, got a regular commission, became a fighter pilot, met a nice woman from Connecticut. We fell in love and we took off for this great adventure. And initially I had problems with motion sickness and all of that, but when it went away, it was as if I was born to be in that. I just started doing exceptionally well throughout flight school. I'd be number two or number three in the class and all the different carrier work or night flying or formation, whatever was going on. It's 18 months of training and I loved it. It was, and there was drinking involved, but we were pretty busy and it was hard to keep up the pace. And I got through that and go out to California to El Toro for some training before I go overseas. We're living on Balboa Island, rented a place down there back in the 50s. I think it was $120 a month. Near the ferry boat on Balboa Island. And had a wonderful 3 months of training there and went overseas into a fighter squadron, and the Korean War ended, so there was nothing to do but train, fly high-performance airplanes, and party. And we partied as a unit, that we would go to the club. Each squadron had their own table. The colonel would, you didn't order a drink till the colonel ordered them. And then he'd go, bring my boys around the drinks, and then 20 drinks would come. And they drank fast enough so that I didn't have to sneak a drink. Have you ever been in a crowd like that, where all 20 drank as fast as you did, and you didn't have, Colonel, I'll be back, I've got to go to the bathroom, and then you went by the bar to get one. And it was wonderful. I could tell you lots of great flying stories and running around Japan drunk, and these. It was tremendously exciting. But about three-quarters of the way through that tour, we were getting ready to go aboard the carrier and practice carrier landings on the field. And I was out the end of the runway with the maintenance officer, Major Newport, who I adored, a big Irish guy. God, he could drink, and he just, you wanted to be like him. And he said to me, you know, Sandy, in about 18 months I'll be a lieutenant colonel, I'll have my own fighter squadron, and I'm going to get nothing but the best pilots in the Marine Corps in that squadron. It's going to be unbelievable. And I'm going, oh, yeah, yeah, right, Major, it's going to be wonderful. And he pointed at me and said, and I want you in that squadron. And I'm a young lieutenant. And I just went, oh, my God, you know, this is, can't get a bigger pat on the back than that. And then he said, but I wouldn't let you drink. I had no idea why he said that. You know what I mean? I pretended I didn't hear it. I mean, I wasn't going to ask him. I just let it go right by me. And it wasn't until I got to AA that I realized that the way alcoholics drink even scares heavy drinkers. I mean, he saw everybody, blah, 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 and then he saw me. And he saw someone drinking with an intensity, with a something that scared him to death. And I thought I was just one of the guys having another beer. So anyway, my career went along. We eventually had six children. I was a forward air controller. I was Pendleton. I was a flight instructor. And then I was in the photo squadron during the Cuban Missile Crisis, and that was the extent of my flying career, because at that point the disease had progressed so far that I was having withdrawal symptoms in the plane. And I was in very bad shape. I was getting in the plane after not drinking for 12 hours, which was the big mistake. I talked to Hal Marley, and he said, you don't do that. You take booze with you in the plane. And I'm like, oh. But you see, the Air Force is a lot smarter than the Marines, and they knew how to do these things, to not be going through withdrawal while you're flying. And so I would have one nightmare after another as that stuff was kicking in, and I would lose consciousness. My heart would race. I would sweat. I would lose peripheral vision, and I'm flying a mission. I mean, it's just... I kept that up for about a year. And I finally could not walk up to the plane and get in it. I just couldn't. I took a look at it, and it was a big airplane, that F-8. I just went, I'm going to go talk to somebody. And I went to a flight surgeon and said, you know, I'm having a few things in the plane. And when he heard about it, he just about died. And I thought, well, you can't be flying with that. But there was no disease of alcoholism. And so even after I was examined for 2 or 3 weeks by flight surgeons down in Pensacola, they couldn't diagnose what I had because it was not a disease in the Navy. There was no such thing as being an alcoholic, so you had to be something else. And so the paperwork came out that, you know, I had high blood pressure, I'm disoriented, I reek of alcohol, I'm covered with clammy sweat, my eyes are all bloodshot, I'm disoriented and shaking and trembling. Clearly, a childhood fear of flying that just showed up after 12 years of flying. It just appeared out of the blue. So that crushed me. I was taken off flight status back to Cherry Point. I had to wait 3 months. I had a regular commission, so they're going to reassign you with a new specialty. I got my orders to be an air traffic controller. And if anybody's in air traffic control, you know, that's a hard school. I make it through the school. I mean, in that condition, I made it through air traffic control school. And now I'm sent overseas in charge of a unit in Japan controlling airplanes, bringing them in, bad weather, they can't find the runway. Just trust us. And there's Sandy down there with one hand. No, I didn't do any controlling. I used to talk about putting my hand over one eye so I'd only see one runway to try and bring the plane into it. But the senior enlisted men knew, and they just said, Captain, you know, here's your tent and your little chair and all that and your coffee, and please don't go near the radar, and don't you talk to any airplanes. And I saw the common sense in that. And so during that year, I just drank and rode my bike and tried to get to work, and it was terrifying because now I was losing weight, I couldn't eat, I lost 50 pounds, I had malnutrition, I stopped hanging out with my buddies, I didn't even go to happy hour. I was trying to survive on soup and vodka. You know what I mean? Just, it had to be liquid, or it was not going to be staying down. And it was a terrifying year. It was just awful. Because I never talked to anybody about it. I just tried to get up every day, do whatever I could. We went on maneuvers to Taiwan. I'll never forget going over there. I had to go over early to an airspace conference with the Taiwanese Air Force on how we were going to have the mutual control of all the airspace around Gongshan while their planes are flying and ours and this and that. And I'm shaking so bad I had to bring a bottle aboard the plane. But when I went through customs, I had to hide it, and they found it and took it away. And the people that were meeting us saw it. I can still see them. They saw the bottle and it going. And so I said, well, tell us what hotel we're going to so I could go get a drink somewhere to calm down. But I didn't get it. I've forgotten this story. And they escorted us. We got in their cars, the official Taiwanese cars, military cars, and went to the hotel. And they walked up to the desk I can still see there's about three of these guys. And they asked the clerk to bring out the reservation, which I had to fill out. I couldn't come close to getting the pencil anywhere near. My hand shook so bad. And I was there, and they were all staring. And it was just, I wasn't even coming close to the thing, dripping sweat. And one of my sergeants came over and said, "Sir, I'll fill that out for you. I'd still be there." You know what I mean? It was, and that was a very typical situation. It was one humiliation after another. When, at the ceremony for President Kennedy, after he was assassinated, we were in the hangar, and I didn't get enough alcohol in my system, and I started to shake. It took 2.5 hours, so I went 2.5 hours without a drink, and I could feel, here we go. You know, I don't know if you've stood at attention while you're shaking, and you know you're going out. You know something's bad is going to happen. I looked at my uniform. It's a khaki uniform. It's now wet. It's changed colors. And I said, I think I should run. No, what do? I'm going to fall. And all of a sudden, they're playing the Star Spangled Banner. The thing has made it. Then I went, if you salute, your hand is going to be going like this. And everybody will turn around going, who's he waving at? Or don't salute, and everybody will go, what is that? He's not saluting the President of the United States. I didn't salute. Just stood there shaking, and guys are going, what are you doing? What are you doing? What are you doing? What are you doing? And all I wanted to do was disappear. Melt into some sweat and go down the sewer rather than look at anyone else in that hangar. I could not make eye contact with my fellow officers. I was too ashamed. And so that was my state of mind when I got sent back to Quantico, Virginia for a career school where I had a grand mal seizure, went into the hospital. After about 5 days, I went into DTs, and that told them that I was crazy. So they put me in a straitjacket and locked me up for 6 months. And so that was my story. And in that 6 months, my health came back, but there was nobody talking about alcoholism. They were talking about crazy, or tell me about your childhood. And the rest of the people in the nut ward, the people with what they called legitimate mental illnesses, didn't feel alcoholics had any place in there. And it was a funny feeling being the low man in the nut ward, you know what I mean? I felt like this at college, and now I got the same feeling in here. But anyway, AA finally talked their way into having a meeting, and I went and forced down the elevator, and I heard about AA. I thought it was great, but I never considered myself an alcoholic. You follow what I'm saying? This is the first time I heard the word, alcoholic. I got childhood fear of flying. You know what I mean? I got malnutrition. I had a seizure. I'm not an alcoholic. I had a seizure. And the DTs. I didn't know only alcoholics had the DTs. So as it came time for me to go home, and they were going to send me back to duty with a entirely new job, I went home a couple weeks where you could go home on weekends and nights, and I decided that it would be okay to have a beer, and the beer led to vodka, and within 10 days, I'm bringing vodka into the nut ward, even though they said, if you ever take another drink, your career's over. And that's where I was when I called AA on December 7th, 1964, and another Marine captain, who is my sponsor, Bill Terwilliger, came to my house and took me to a meeting, and I had been sober about 3 hours, and lasted 5 hours. It was a group anniversary with food. They celebrated. They had a square dance with fiddles. And I'm dying. I need to get out of there. please take me home. But I went out and there was no place to go. It was an old remote Oddfellows Hall. There was no street lights. It was like drizzly rain, cold December. And I just was standing on the porch. I was just going to make a break for it. It looked like there was woods over there or something. I just, whoa. And this I remember, a hand came on my shoulder. It was an Al-Anon lady named Betsy Lynch. And she and her husband became very good friends of mine. And it was like an angel. I felt it, and I turned around, and she was standing there. And you know how when you see, there's this face? And she said, "It's going to be all right. Come on back in." And I believed her. I just went, "Oh, good." And I went back in. That was it. I never fought anything after that. It was just the fight was over. I was a full AA member after that one touch. "It's going to be all right. Come on back in." I got the same sponsor today. He's very ill. His name is Bill Terwilliger, and he's been struggling with lung cancer for some years, but he's tough. He is tough. And about 3 months ago, the Manassas group, this is the group where I was at, called me up and said, "We're having our 55th anniversary. Could you come up and speak at it?" And I said, "Oh boy, I'll be glad to." And my sponsor and his home group, which is down near Fredericksburg, Virginia, they got him up and they got the wheelchair. They brought him to the meeting, and we had a big reunion in the same meeting that he brought me to 42 years earlier. And I got photographs of he and I together, and we reminisced, and it's just remarkable. And shortly after that, his home group called me and they said, "Oh, he's taken a turn for really bad. It looks like the whole system is shutting down. So just be on standby." So I'm on standby. You know, I go on a speaking engagement, I'm calling in, no messages from them. I'm on standby, and I'm on standby, and finally I call him up after about a month. I said, "What's the standby?" I said, "Oh, I know." I said, "I'm going to call his where he's staying in this hospice-type house." He answers the phone. I was going to call and check on him. And he said, "Hi, Bill." And I said, "Bill, how you doing?" "Great. I was just out for a walk." Well, I guess I won't ask about standby status anymore. And about two more months have gone by. And every time I call him, he sounds stronger. So the last time we talked, we both agreed we would shoot for 50 years together, you know. So maybe a dream, but it's kind of a fun thing to have the one person thing. To have that one person who was there, you know what I mean? It was like, those were the days when you didn't pick a sponsor. They came to your house. That was the guy that came to your house. So there wasn't any agony or angst over, is this the right sponsor? Is this the right, you know, it was determined by God. You know, knock, knock, knock. "Hi, God sent me. Get in the car." So I'm delighted I don't have to go through this. So how do you pick a sponsor? You're going to be like, suppose you had to pick your own parents. Well, let me tell you, I'm going to get that. How do I know they'll take care of them? Anyway, haven't had a drink since that night. We went off on the journey. I didn't get to finish my career in the Marine Corps. My drinking caught up to me, and we both didn't get promoted. You have to get promoted to major. And we didn't get promoted the first year. You get two tries. The second year, he made it. I didn't. I'm out with my six kids. Did everything I was asked, have this new loving God who saw fit to crap all over a family of eight. That's the way I saw it. Now, wait a minute, God, I'm just starting to trust you, and you have taken me and my six kids and my wife and dumped us out in the street after I went to a meeting every night. I did everything I was asked. What is this? What it is a resentment. That's what that is. There's no other name for it. It's a resentment. It sounds like a very unjust, a terrible experience, unfair. No, that's not what it is. It is a resentment. And I knew that in AA, if you talked about these resentments, they could get it away from you. They could wrestle it out of your hands. So I didn't talk to anybody. I just stayed home, thought about it. And I elevated it from a minor incident to possibly the greatest tragedy that ever happened to anyone, was to be treated that unfairly with the family of eight. You always had to throw in, and the family of eight. Mostly it was happening to me. They were in the periphery. And 3 months later, the guys I was working with, we traveled around the country and put on a show about the Marine Corps, the future and all that. Very high-level deal. They were all killed in a plane crash going to Denver to put on a show. And if I had had my way and life was fair, I would have been on the plane. And I can still have that feeling when I read it. I felt sheepish, like, oh, well, that's different. Maybe it's not as unfair as I thought it was. And then I knew God knew that I had seen the article, and then I had nowhere to hide, and I just mumbled, well, if you just told me that was going to happen, I wouldn't have been so upset. Anyway, since that time, I've learned a lot about how to look at life, which is really what sobriety is. Chuck is absolutely right. A new pair of glasses. It is the power to see things differently. And when we see them differently, we're very comfortable with what we see. I like to think of sobriety as the condition in which there's nothing for alcohol to fix. There's no urgency to change anything in the present moment. And when there's nothing for alcohol to fix, it's pretty easy to not drink. What would you need a drink for? Why would you drink if everything's perfect? You know, in other words, the reason I drank is because I had a serious problem. And I don't have serious problems anymore. I think I mentioned Polly P, who doesn't do mortifying anymore. It is the power that is available here to see everything differently. And if I can't see it quickly, I call somebody to ask to help me how to see it. This is what my program now consists of. I get slightly bent out, I'm a little frightened, I'm a little resentful, whatever little thing has hit me, I call my sponsor or my new group of friends in Tampa who I've known for 10 years now, and I just call them up, and we have, and most of them are working, I'm retired now, and I call them at their office, and the secret password is, Larry, can I run something by you? Now what that means is 45 seconds max. You follow what I'm saying? That's the secret password. You're only going to be on the phone 45 seconds. So even if he's with a client, he'll say, sure. And then I go, okay, brief synopsis. I said this, and this over there, the guy came over, and da-da. And then he says, okay, here's the deal. That other guy is totally wrong. He must have had the worst night, and his wife must have been all over him. He is totally off the wall, 100% wrong. Forgive him. There's only two things that happen. That's one, all in 45 seconds. Two is, you're totally, you overreacted. There's no reason you should have said that back. Go make an amend. Click. It's very simple. The point of the phone call is to become undisturbed again, so that when you take another look around, everything's fine. Now, I do not know how to do that alone. That's a very important thing to understand, that the process in Alcoholics Anonymous is not a process towards independence, it's a process towards further dependence. You never get to be self-sufficient again. If my ego wants to keep going, okay, I think we've got it, Sandy. Tell him goodbye. We got it again. The old team, you and me. And that's the struggle, I think, that we all have, is the illusion that somehow I will be able to live life on my own. And so I've jumped all the way to the end of the spiritual story just to say that that's the point of the whole deal, is to never live alone and never be disconnected from a perspective changer, whether it's through prayer, meditation, or running things by someone else. And we learned that in the fifth step. I mean, it was right there. We wrote the fourth step out. We were thorough. We were honest. It was just, there it was in all its glory. And then it says in the list, well, at the top of the list is rationalization. So how do you know that list is worth anything? How do you know it has any value or credence at all? It's impossible for you to look at a four-step list and see it in its true light. So how do you see it? Well, how do they show a 3D movie? Two projectors, right? Two projectors. It takes two sets of eyes to look at that list. So it's your sponsor or the priest or whoever you bring this to. A third dimension is now applied to the two-dimensional document. And the totality of our life comes out by sharing it. And that's why it's so simple. Can I run something by you? Can I run something by you? It's like, can you help me see this in 3D? Could you help me see with this with perspective? Oh. Now, the first time I did that was, and we all did that, we run to our sponsor, the sky's falling, sky's falling, sky's falling, sky's falling, whatever your story is, the sky's falling, sky's falling, sky's falling. She did this, he did this. And then he sits you down, he goes, okay, all right. And then he says, now, of course, on the other hand, you got your sponsor, you got your AA, your health is returning. I think I said this the other day. And when you get through, you go, oh, well, if you look at it that way, it's not so bad. That's what this is all about. Is the power to see it that way, to see through the story that I put together, the old ideas that I brought and assembled all by myself. I mean, think about the fact that I'm 45 years old, still believing in a threatening God that I put together when I was 10. And so I said, well, do you want to rethink that God thing? No, I was 10, and I clearly thought about it. You were 10, and you're not going to reconsider the position. No, I'm not. Why? Because it's mine. I put this together. My ideas are very important. I believe in convictions. When you feel strongly about something, you should hold on to it. It's very important. You see what a joke this is? But that's what self-centeredness does. It makes me grab a hold of the ideas that I assembled as if letting go of them could be life-threatening. That's how it feels. To relinquish, okay, I'm going to try getting help. Probably kill me. And then help comes in, and then we got 1,000 other things to let go of, and we go, okay, well, that worked when I let go of that, like our sixth step said, the riddle of our existence. Okay, I let go of alcohol, I got perfect release, it was wonderful, I can't believe it. Oh, you want me to let go of these other 1,000 things? oh, I don't know, I think I should probably hold on to them. I should probably continue holding on to them. Chuck said, uncover, discover, discard. You know what that's really saying, no matter how long we've been sober? It's just saying, what else am I wrong about? What a healthy thing to be thinking about. What else am I wrong about? Scott and I were talking about this when he was in Tampa. We're talking about the different type of conversation that a bunch of guys have, and I'm sure a bunch of gals have a similar thing. Back before we came into AA, whether you were drinking or sober, you were just a guy, and you got together with other peers, and you said, well, how's it going? How's it going? How's it going? You heard a little exaggeration. You know what I'm talking? Oh, man, we closed a couple deals yesterday. You got a big cigar. You wouldn't believe what we did down there. Oh, you think that's a big deal? Well, I was out here, I shot a 75. Went over there, there were three girls, you wouldn't believe it. And I went down here, you wouldn't believe it. Got a new Cadillac, you wouldn't believe it. And they go all the way around the table with these remarkable stories. Now we come in here, take the same guys. Now we gather around the table, we're having lunch, and somebody says, well, how'd it go? Oh, God, you're not going to believe what I did this week. I really screwed up. I lost my temper on Wednesday with my boss. I felt like a complete jerk. Anyway, I called my sponsor and I went back and I made an amend. Not to be outdone, the second guy says, you call that screwing up? Wait till I tell you what I did. I told three lies and I almost whacked one of my kids. I had to go back and I had to. Then the fourth guy, you call that screwing up? And we ended up trying to top each other on screw ups that we did. That is so healthy. That is so wonderful that we are reviewing, what else am I wrong about? What else should I be getting rid of? What other burden can I discard? Until I idea by idea by idea, I return to my natural self, which is the most heavenly thing we could ever be. Spiritually, we already are all that we can ever become. There's no way that I could be a better person than I was born. I made up a story that I'm not that wonderful person. And I lived in that story. And that story is not unlike a block of granite, because it is tough to chisel away that story. Alcoholics don't give up lightly their position on things. When we say entrenched, we're talking about entrenched. When we say let go and let God, we're talking about try to make me let go. Like there's concrete around that fist. Let me see you. And so we start this process of chipping away. And it may be a little bit painful. I don't know if it's painful to a block of granite or marble when the sculptor is working. Chip, 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 chip. But the sculptor knows, and our Creator knows, that what's going to be revealed in the center of that block of granite or block of marble is magnificent. And everybody in this room is that magnificent center. And when we say more will be revealed, we're not talking about out there, we're talking about in here. More will be revealed of what your true nature really is. And so I look at the whole process of the steps as chipping away. And we need a sculptor to help us. We need a sponsor. We subject ourselves to the process. Very often, we are brought to the process through humiliation. But true humility is when we voluntarily subject ourselves to more chipping away. and we go somewhere, we ask other people to help us, what else should I get rid of? What do you see in me that needs to be changed? And this process goes on as long as we're alive. But as long as we're engaged in it, our attitude towards the painful chipping changes because we see the value of subjecting ourselves to this getting rid of process. Spirituality has nothing to do with learning anything or getting anything. It has to do with unlearning and letting go of. This is what's a mystery to people who are intellects. I'm going, okay, I got it. No, you don't have it. You have to let go of it. The process is going to happen to you. You make yourself available to it. You become open. You ask, what else can I get rid of? And that's what inventories are for. And I look at the 10th step as the daily indication of what needs to go next. And how do you know what needs to go next? You're upset about it. That's how when I was first started flying, this analogy has always struck strong with me. When I first started flying, we had the radio range. And that's a long time ago, because it was replaced almost 3 years later with the needle, so you could see where you were going, and then DME, you knew how far it was, and now, my God, they got the satellites, and you know exactly where you are. But the only way you could navigate was through your ears, and you listened in Morse code for the signal of where you were going. Once you ascertained that that was the airport, or the radio range leading you to the airport, then you either heard an A or an M, dit-da or dot-bit. And from that, you had an idea of which two quadrants you were in, as you looked at a chart, and you were either northeast of the airport or southwest of it. And then there was a procedure called a fade 90, and then you narrowed it down to this one, and then you flew towards the leg that was drawn on the map, and as you approached the leg, you heard the A plus a solid beam. And as you got closer to the beam, you turned on the heading of the beam, and then you listened to stay on the beam. And when you were on the beam, it went B. And as you drifted off to the right, it would be B. Oh, and you went, I'm going a little to the right, and you had to make a correction back. And then if you went over to the left, then you hear, I got to make a correction back. So the only way you knew you were on course was when you went off course. You follow what I'm saying? You never just stayed on course. If you just heard beep, you went, there's something wrong. Because that's impossible. The wind is blowing, and the beam is getting narrower and narrower. So in other words, all of navigating was making tiny corrections from being off course. That was how that whole mysterious world communicated to you by giving you little nudges. Okay, back. In flying the spiritual beam, its disturbances are how we navigate. I'm going along. You know what a disturbance. You know, I don't feel like I did a little while ago. What does that say? Going off course. Going over to disturbed. You follow what I'm saying? Bad. Off course. And the top priority is back on course. Back to undisturbed. And that's where we have that quick process. Self-restraint. Don't get angry and crash the plane into the ground that you're off course. Honest analysis of what's wrong. Call somebody up. Bum, 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 bum. Okay, turn left. Thank you. Boom. Willingness to forgive. Willingness to make amends. All of that is done very quickly to go back to being undisturbed. Undisturbed, you can be guided. Not disturbed, you got to navigate. You have to figure life out. You have to make all the decisions of what the next right thing is to do. On the beam, God's making the decisions. I'm just doing what He is telling me. Well, how does He talk to me? When you're disturbed, you go back. That's how he talks to you. That's how the whole deal works. We just keep shooting as a top priority to stay undisturbed. I couldn't believe how simple that was. Anything simple is not liked by us alcoholics, because we are very complex people, and we don't want our problem to be solved that simply. Remember when we came and said, oh, you just have to not drink. Come on, it's got to be bigger than that. And so if you're new, I just want to wrap up by saying the journey you're on is an inward one. You are, allegedly, you came here to stop drinking. But there's no way to stay here by just not drinking. You're going to have to engage in this journey. And everyone in this room wants to go there with you. And as the years go by, you will be standing up here at your 10th sober vacation, at your 15th sober vacation. And if we could have a series of photographs, you would see that the sculptor is transforming you into the magnificent creation that you are. And it's my pleasure every year to watch everyone transform. And it's the greatest sight I've ever seen. Thank you all very much.